Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Monday, join us for a personal tour of Who's Reading the Organon, a show hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook. She invites you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts as we complete reading Samuel Hahnemann's Organon. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. I'm wondering if there's any sound today. It doesn't appear as if my telephone is in here live. So if anybody's there, I'd like to know if you can hear me. If not, I might have to call in. There's a guest in there. I'm just checking on my sound level today. And there are a couple of guests, so please let me know if you hear me. If not, I might have to hang up and call in to the switchboard again. And I'll just start talking until I see some responses. Okay. sometimes these things happen. Well, I am Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community, and I'd like to talk a little bit about some inspiration, current events, and read the words of Dr. Samuel Hahnemann in The Organon of Medicine. Today is December 13, 2010, and you're listening to show number 124. So I'm waiting to see if anybody is responding in the live chat over here, and I'll also check in the World Homeopathy Awareness live chat and ask if anybody is there and if they can hear me. Anyone there? And can you hear me? So it's really, really good if we can get feedback on this one. I'll continue to talk, and if I have to, I might have to sign out again, like I said, and start over again. So I want to remind everyone that this is a simple study session. We have 1 hour to talk, and all listeners should consult their health care provider for their personal care. For people who are inviting new members to join the Homeopathy World Community Network, I'd like to let you all know that there is a wonderful page that can help people to get started, how to guide them in filling out their profile to their application, and to realize that this is a professional network of homeopaths and healers from around the globe and advocates of homeopathy, and you do need to have that connection. So you need to know someone who is a member or have some really strong connection with homeopathy. Also, if you're on the Blog Talk Radio website, go to Who's Reading the Organon and click friend, favorite, add a comment if you were able to listen to the show. Let us know how it was. And you can listen at any time by downloading the old shows and the archives to your computer, iTunes, or iPod. And don't forget to go ahead and visit the Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio group, where I do my best to do a blog about each show. I'm not absolutely efficient about getting it done every week or every day, but I do as many as I can, and there's a place for you to comment if you are a member of Homeopathy World Community. Today's inspirational quote is a German proverb, and it was from Twitter by Dean Boedeker. It says, "Enough is better than too much," and maybe everyone can relate to that one. In many ways, we know just when we've had enough, and that is our limit. We have boundaries. We have times when we feel that we have been overloaded with work or responsibility. And homeopathic terms, giving just the right dose, just the right quantity, the minimum dose, is better than too much. Because just in every other way that you feel too much is an overload on your system, in the same way, homeopathically, when you have just the right amount of energy that stimulates the healing response, that is really all that you need. The next inspirational quote comes again from Twitter, and I see, oh, Cynthia, I bless you. Bless you for commenting and letting me know that you can hear me, because I've got my headphones on today, but I cannot hear through my headphones. So in most probability, I am talking directly into my computer speaker and not through the headphones. I'm not exactly sure what's happening, but I'm very happy to know that you can hear my voice out there on the internet. So Rocking Jude from Twitter has sent out a tweet that says, without learning, men are incapable of knowing their rights. And I thought that was very pertinent about learning and education and becoming an educated person. You know, it has been reported that the most educated people are using homeopathy more than those who are not educated. And in terms of the show that we do on vaccinations and your rights in the United States, that is one of our mottos, that we must educate before we vaccinate. Therefore, knowledge is really powerful for us individually, for caring for our families, for our children, for our spouses and partners, and for our friends, to educate them and let them know all the information that you have at hand about healing and the power of homeopathy. And one more inspirational quote for today comes from C.S. Lewis, who wrote, "You are never too old to set another goal or to dream a new dream." So if you feel as if you used to have a dream as a child or a young adult and you're much older, and the time has passed you by and you perhaps missed an opportunity, it is never too late to see in something else in your future to motivate you and inspire you to move forward in your life. And I wanted to read another inspirational quote. It's simply an aphorism. Aphorism number 46 from Hahnemann's Organon of Medicine. It states, many examples might be adduced of diseases which in the course of nature have been homeopathically cured by other diseases presenting similar symptoms were it not necessary, as our object is to speak about something determinate and indubitable, to confine our attention solely to those few diseases which are invariably the same, arise from a fixed miasm, and hence merit a distinct name. Among these, the smallpox, so dreaded on account of the great number of its serious symptoms, occupies a prominent position, and it has removed and cured a number of maladies with similar symptoms. How frequently does smallpox produce violent ophthalmia, sometimes even causing blindness, and see by its inoculation, Dizotto cured a chronic ophthalmia permanently, and Leroy another. An amaurosis of 2 years' duration, consequent on suppressed scald head, was perfectly cured by it, according to Klein. And how often does smallpox cause deafness and dyspnea? And both these chronic diseases, it removed on reaching its acme, as J.F.R. Kloss observed. Swelling of the testicle, even of a very severe character, is a frequent symptom of smallpox, and on this account it was enabled, as Klein observed, to cure by virtue of similarity a large hard swelling of the left testicle consequent on a bruise. And another observer saw a similar swelling of the testicle cured by it. Among the troublesome symptoms of smallpox is the dysenteric state of the bowels, and it subdued, as F.R. Wind observed, a case of dysentery as a similar morbific agent. Smallpox coming on after vaccination, as well on account of its greater strength as its great similarity. It once removes entirely the cowpox homeopathically and does not permit it to come to maturity. But on the other hand, the cowpox, when near maturity, does, on account of its great similarity, homeopathically diminish very much the supervening smallpox and make it much milder, as Murray and many others testify. And within that one long aphorism, number 46, there are numerous footnotes to telling who were the provers or who were the observers of those particular curative agents. And what he teaches us here is that there are similar morbific agents, similar substances that cause disease that can also be used for healing. There is continuation of this aphorism, I guess. It's quite long. I didn't realize I didn't go fully through it. I will continue. The inoculated cowpox, whose lymph besides the protective matter contains the contagion of a general cutaneous eruption of another nature, consisting of usually small, dry, rarely large pustular pimples, resting on a small red areola, frequently conjoined with round red cutaneous spots and often accompanied by the most violent itching, which rash appears in not a few children several days before, more frequently, however, after the red areola of the cowpox, and goes off in a few days, leaving behind small red hard spots on the skin. The inoculated cowpox, I say, after it has taken cures perfectly and permanently in a homeopathic manner by the similarity of this accessory miasm, analogous cutaneous eruptions of children, often of very long standing, of a very troublesome character, as a number of observers assert. The cowpox, a peculiar symptom of which is to cause tumefaction of the arm, cured after it broke out, a swollen, half-paralyzed arm. The fever accompanying cowpox, which occurs at the time of the production of the red areola, cured homeopathically intermittent fever in two individuals, as the younger Hardeggi reports, confirming what J. Hunter had already observed, that two fevers, similar diseases, cannot coexist in the same body. And I'm going to repeat that, two similar diseases cannot coexist in the same body. And that is the principle upon which homeopathy rests in terms of providing for the individual an artificial similar disease. And thus the body is responding to the artificial disease in order to cure the actual natural disease. Going on with what Hahnemann says, the measles bears a strong resemblance in the character of its fever and cough to the whooping cough, and hence it was that Busquillon noticed in an epidemic where both these affections prevailed that many children who took measles remained free from whooping cough. They would all have been protected from and rendered incapable of being infected by the whooping cough in that and all subsequent epidemics by the measles, if the whooping cough were not a disease that has only a partial similarity to the measles. That is to say, if it had also a cutaneous eruption similar to what the latter possesses. As it is, however, the measles can but preserve a large number from whooping cough, and that only in the epidemic prevailing at the time. If, however, the measles come in contact with a disease resembling it in its chief symptom, the eruption, it can indisputably remove and effect a homeopathic cure of the latter. Thus, a chronic herpetic eruption was entirely and permanently and homeopathically cured by the breaking out of the measles, as Quartum observed. An excessively burning miliary rash on the face, neck, and arms that had lasted 6 years was aggravated by every change of weather, On the invasion of measles assumed the form of a swelling on the surface of the skin. After the measles had run its course, the exanthem was cured and returned no more. So we are learning so much in this one aphorism that it is my inspiration for today. And the reason I say that is because I wanted to talk a little bit about vaccinations today and what's going on generally in our neighborhoods, in our local areas, what's going on in the media to tell us that we are going to be in another epidemic or pandemic or influenza season, and what it is that you need to do to take care of the situation. So I'm going to let that percolate in your thoughts about what Hahnemann has told us. And I'm going to switch over to some little tidbits in the network. There is an incredible group on HWC, Homeopathy World Community, called Clinical Tips. And there we have some professional homeopaths putting their best hints about particular symptoms or illnesses and remedies that they use or anything that they find helpful to share with others. Also, Dana Ullman has produced a wonderful video. I have it on the front page of HWC. It's an interview with Dr. Frank Lippmann. Dana talks about the body's own wisdom, about listening to this natural intellect for healing that we have within ourselves. And if the more we learn Hahnemann's Organon of Medicine, the more we will understand how our healing works, what basic foundational principles the healing works with. And that's the purpose of this radio show. And homeopathy can be used for ear infections, fevers, and so many other illnesses, as recorded in the previous aphorism number 46 that I read today at the beginning of the show, even to the extent that we're talking about serious epidemic contagious diseases. So you can see how powerful it is. Homeopathy is also a very holistic method of treatment and may be more difficult to apply. Dana says it may be more difficult to apply to adults by the layperson. And this is quite true because a homeopath, a professional homeopath, takes years and years of training. Many in India and other countries are actually MDs, as well as trained homeopaths. Also, when a person goes to the general store and health food store and purchases remedies on their own, they may see a label on the bottle, but that does not really tell them and signify all the symptoms and signs and how to use that remedy. You need to have some more training. So it's a little bit more complicated than just picking a bottle off the shelf. And therefore, the most reliable and examples of cure and relief of symptoms will be occurring from those who are most knowledgeable, which goes back to the original quote that I said at the beginning, how powerful knowledge is for understanding and for application of any kind of professional medical system. Dana also tells us that the most educated persons use homeopathy, and take a listen to that video in the interview. He tells a story about Darwin, and he also lists a number of celebrities and important people who profess to use homeopathy regularly. He indicates that Arnica Montana is the most well-known and often used homeopathic remedy used by surgeons and athletes. And it does prove that homeopathy works. It seems to me if homeopathy works in one case for one remedy, it indicates that it works for all the others too, especially as shown through the reading of aphorism number 46. All of the footnotes relate to actual homeopaths in their practice and their proving experience or their actual clinical experience in the field with people who have contagious diseases that were alleviated and cured for one reason or another using homeopathy, homeopathic remedies, or illustrating, which he was doing, that two similar diseases cannot coexist in the same body. And then I would not want to forget our wonderful Dr. Kaur, who is now in Pakistan and hopefully is going to return to America soon. And he has written a blog about Bellus perennis for sore muscles and injury. And I recommend that you go ahead and take a look over there. It's called Bellus perennis, if arnica fails. And very often, arnica is not going to cover every ache and pain and muscle soreness and bumps and bruise, but there are indications for other remedies in similar families or even not in a similar family that can cover similar symptoms and illnesses. And I'd like to let you know also that we have our iPaper. It's http://paper.li/, and my name, Debbie Brooke. That's a capital Debbie and a capital Brooke, /homeopath. This is an online newspaper that you can send to people to read the daily updates. There are 157 contributors to this online paper called the Homeopath Daily. You will find the link to that and a tweet on the front page of HWC. There is also an incredible article in the Huffington Post about vitamin D. And this is an article by Dr. Frank Lippmann, the one who interviewed Dana Allman. It's worth a look. It's worth a read because this is preventative medicine to use vitamin D, which is called vitamin, but it's really a hormone. It's something that is substance made within our own bodies based on the amount of sunlight that we get each day, and it has phenomenal healing potential for all of us, and we need to learn more about this vitamin D. There is also, and I'm just shouting out to all these wonderful things going on the internet that you can participate as listeners, commenters, share it with your friends, tweet it up, do whatever you can to let other people know. There's a BBC presentation, an audio called A Brave Medical Life, The Founder of Homeopathy. It's a story about Samuel Hahnemann, and I think that you will enjoy listening. Write a blog about it, comment, see what you think about the BBC and their reporting. Also, if you remember the swine flu pandemic, it was a disease that swept the world last year, sparking a global health emergency and costing the United Kingdom alone at least £1 billion. Plans were made to cope with up to 65,000 deaths in Britain after the virus emerged in Mexico in April of 2009, and it began its journey around the world. The government ordered 132 million doses of vaccine, two for every person in the country, and launched a national flu pandemic service to hand out millions of courses of Tamiflu to ward off the killer threat. Now, is that hype or what? Now, experts say the pandemic flu ended up saving lives rather than costing them. It did that by driving out the seasonal flu, which targets the more vulnerable elderly. Official figures published last week show that there was a dramatic drop in deaths last winter, the coldest in 30 years. Excess winter mortality was 30% lower in 2009 and 2010 than in the milder winter of 2008 and 2009. So what does this tell us? What can we learn from this? When we know that when there's colder weather, people are more prone to catch colds, in a weaker immune state, and yet 30%, that is a phenomenal statistical number. And to think that we had this huge pandemic announced by the World Health Organization and it ended up to be a dud, because most people did not even get the flu vaccination, the swine flu vaccine, H1N1, which was not even tested properly. We didn't know what it could do. And there was just a big hype, and today you're hearing it all over again. So the question is, what did we learn? This harkens back to aphorism number 46. Two similar diseases cannot exist in the same body at the same time. Therefore, if you did get the flu and you survived the flu, it says the mortality rate was down 30%. If you usually you die from pneumonia anyway, you're not going to be dying from the flu. You're going to die from some complication of being in a weakened state to begin with. And therefore, we learn again that getting an illness is actually boosting our immune system, because then we have lifelong immunity. The people who were exposed to the H1N1 back in the 50s, I believe it was, or the 70s, whenever it was, if you were exposed to the virus and your body built up an immune, you have a natural inner-born immune system rather than having to get boosters and weakening your own immune system, telling your own immune system that you don't know what you're doing when you get a fever. When you get a fever, your body's responding properly to an onslaught of some sort of a virus or a bacteria or something. Let's see what else we've got going today. On California, health officials urge the flu vaccine, right? So in Los Angeles, there's an AP newsletter. Health officials say all Californians older than 6 months old should get the flu vaccine this year. They're broadening their recommendations from previous years. The state epidemiologist, Dr. Gil Chavez, says this year's influenza vaccine, trivalent, that's composed of three strains, trivalent, will protect against the H1N1 virus and two other strains of the virus. The question is, we don't know what strain of the virus is actually out there, do we? So what are we putting in our bodies? That's the question. One of these days I'm going to read the entire list of ingredients. It'll take a whole show to just list all the things that are in one of our vaccinations. In the past, flu vaccines were encouraged for immune-compromised populations like the elderly, and the state is now experiencing sporadic flu activity, which is expected to increase in the fall and winter. Statewide, 1.8 million free vaccinations will be given through the Vaccines for Children program, and another 800,000 free doses are being distributed to local health departments. You have to understand that somebody has purchased those vaccinations. And moving along to the story about the H1N1 miscarriages and hundreds of women claim miscarriage after taking vaccine. Here is a problem that I foresee. This was reported December 2nd. Reports are coming in from women all across the globe connecting the H1N1 vaccine to miscarriages. And the frightening thing is that the manufacturers of these vaccines clearly state in their literature that they do not even know if this vaccine can harm the unborn child or even perhaps prevent women from conceiving later on. And yet, these pregnant women have been a priority number one target to receive this vaccine. While our administration and countries across the globe have been pushing pregnant women to the front of the line for the H1N1, we are now discovering much heartache from those who listened, received the vaccine, and are now sure that it caused them to lose their unborn child. You can go to about.com and read about that with a list of 100 testimonials from individual women. There are a number of other websites where you can read about this situation. Novartis literature plainly states 8.1 pregnancy alarming. Pregnancy category C. Animal reproduction studies have not been conducted with influenza A, H1N1 2009, monovalent vaccine, or fluorine. It is also not known whether influenza A, H1N1 2009 monovalent vaccine or fluvirin can cause fetal harm when administered to a pregnant woman or can affect reproduction capacity. Influenza A H1N1 2009 monovalent vaccine should be given to a pregnant woman only if clearly needed. We don't have a description of when, what those conditions would be. And also there's another report there about nursing mothers. We don't know whether this H1N1 vaccine is excreted into the human milk and should exercise caution when administering the vaccine to nursing women. So how many women know this? This is a question. How many doctors are telling their patients about this situation and giving them the full disclosure, giving them the knowledge to make a educated decision? And that's why you need to let people know. Okay, and there are risk groups warned over UK flu deaths. So just recently in the Irish Times, it says that pregnant women and those who with chronic conditions such as lung and heart disease have been urged to get the year's flu vaccine after a number of swine flu-related deaths in the UK in recent weeks. It was confirmed on Saturday that 10 people had died from the H1N1 virus in the UK over the past 6 weeks. Its health protection agency said the 10 deaths had occurred in adults under the age of 65, most of whom had underlying health issues. So we see that we're going to hear quite a few more stories like this. And again, educate before you vaccinate. Flu is at low levels, but they are warning and threatening that it will be increasing. And they're going to let you know any of this information. The question is, do they have absolute confirmation that these people died of H1N1? I'd like to get that information. Okay, there's a lot more on vaccinations that I could talk about. One more thing, one more bit of news on that regard. For dogs, flu season is all the time. And I read that on JS Online. As you schedule flu shots for yourself and your children, they tell you you might want to consider doing the same for the canine members of your family. If you haven't heard of canine influenza virus, CIV, or the dog flu, you're probably not alone. The disease was first identified in 2004. And while humans typically line up for vaccinations in the fall to protect them during the colder months, dogs can get the disease at any time. Dogs affected by the CIV infection experience a respiratory infection. For most dogs, it is mild illness, but some get very sick and the disease can cause lingering health issues. So you want to know that, as with any epidemic, any influenza, it is contagious. And they say that most dogs have not built up immunity to disease. They claim that it's relatively new. I'd be interested in learning a little bit more about that. The dogs can get the disease by being exposed to other dogs that have it, as well as playing with toys or drinking from bowls used by other dogs. And this makes absolute sense because we know that that is how contagious diseases are transmitted through mucous membranes. Humans cannot contract the disease. That is good to know. But they can spread it through their clothing or other items that have come in contact with infected dogs. So here's the question. How long before your dog is licking your clothing will that contagious disease be able to spread to another dog? That's a good question, and I hope maybe somebody has an answer to that. It is stated that the virus has been detected in 34 states so far since it was first identified in Florida in racing greyhounds in 2004. I think that the greyhounds have very sensitive respiratory systems. And there is a website that you can track the dog flu. It's called www.doginfluenza.com. They tell us that the dog flu is really difficult to detect because dogs become sick before they start showing symptoms. That's very So maybe what they mean is not that they become sick, but that they have already contracted the disease before they actually show symptoms like coughing. And therefore, because it's such a new disease, they're saying from 2004, it's already 6 years old, that many veterinarians are not experienced in identifying it, and that the disease can be serious, and although most dogs do recover from the flu. I'm wondering what kind of healing, energetic work, whether in the dog's diet or getting them out to get their sunshine, take them for a walk. And if you see a dog that is out there coughing or sneezing or whatever, keep them clear from that other dog and make sure that your dog drinks from his own bowl of water. Okay, so that's basically what we're going to talk about for the dog, except that they, of course, I want to mention that they have developed a no-BiVac canine flu H3N8 vaccine. It was launched under a conditional license in 2009 and fully licensed by the USDA in 2010. Yay! Another vaccine. Like the human flu vaccine, it does not guarantee your dog won't be infected, but it can significantly decrease the severity and spread of the dog flu. Now, how can it do that? Maybe somebody can explain that. By getting your dog vaccinated, they say, you can save on potential costs of treating the disease as well as promote canine health by helping prevent its spread. Well, somebody look into it and find out all the components and ingredients in that dog flu virus vaccine and see what that tells us. Okay, we're going to go ahead. We've got 20 minutes to study our organon, and we're going to continue the teachings on provings, which we've been doing for the past number of weeks, which are purely scientific investigations into the effects of medicines on healthy subjects. These provings, and I've compared them to clinical trials, are done properly with supervision, and they are extremely scientific in nature. With as many variables accounted for as we have been reading since aphorism number 115 or so, it is with the utmost care that the homeopath must know every detail of each medicine, the origin of the substance, and keep detailed records of the subjects. If you're a supervisor, that is, each person who is undertaking and being a participant in the proving records their mental, emotional, physical state. Any changes in their state, they are writing it down in a journal. The procedures for giving and taking the medicines in the smallest amount, as we know, the right amount is just the right amount and is more than enough, and that there be no interference from dietary habits and lifestyle stresses. Hahnemann has elaborated on that in previous aphorisms about what kind of a diet a prover must be taking so that there's no interference with, let's say, coffee or other substances that might cause some sort of a physical, or mental, or emotional response. The subjects must have high character qualities and have a screening before they are admitted into the proving group. So we understand what their baseline is before we even begin to see what changes they have. Even the smallest change must be noted in the journals and accurately tabulated. We learn that certain persons are hypersensitive, and that makes them actually a very good subject to ascertain the power of these drugs. We know that we don't do mixtures or combinations. No mixtures of drugs should be made, as the outcome would be uncertain of which drug was producing a proving effect. You can see how scientific it is. We eliminate as many variables as possible. Precise instructions are given in aphorism number 123, and dietary regulations are provided in aphorism number 125. Hahnemann was wise enough to teach in aphorism number 127 that age matters, and one medicine may have different effects depending on the person's gender. I would like to read a short excerpt from Dr. David Little, who is a homeopathic authority on provings. And he says, lifestyle and habits, these are cardinal general symptoms. Let me just check on the network if we've got no callers today, just listeners. Lifestyle and habits are cardinal general symptoms. How a person chooses to live and what they like to do are very characteristic symptoms. These symptoms offer great insights into the personality of the patient and their negative mental state. Investigating how a person lives often reveals indiscretions in diet, rest, and exercise, as well as substance abuse and other areas that produce unneeded stress and strain. And we learn a lot from that, because if we would just change those things, improve diet, get more rest, get more exercise, and remove any substance abuse, even including too much TV or computer, I imagine, that, and we kind of tweaked our relationships and removed excess stress. You know, when your body's telling you, when you're getting a migraine or stomach ache, and you know it's because you're overstressed, well, before you get to that point, pull back and tailor your time and your energy and what it is that you're doing. So just with that bit of information alone, we could probably cure 75 to 90% of illness, most likely. But you know how hard that is to do. So that's where our homeopathic remedies come in to help us. David Little also says that the civic and domestic relationships are important. Excuse me. These rubrics include family dynamics as well as social relationships, how a person relates to their mate, family relations, children, friends, coworkers, and society offers many signs and symptoms. These situational rubrics are a very important source of significant symptoms. Dysfunctional relationships produce illness as well as forming maintaining causes that keep up the disease state. So here we have maintaining causes. So no matter what you do, homeopathically or otherwise, if the problem is still there, the causative problem, the maintaining problem, such as eating paint that has lead on it and the kid keeps eating the paint off the wall instead of cleaning up that problem, the problem is not going to go away on its own. David Little also talks about age. The stages of life are a very important part of time and progression in homeopathy. The critical times are conception, birth, childhood, puberty, adolescence, middle age, and old age. Some remedies work particularly well on babies, while others are more suited to the elderly. Excuse me. I've been talking without any water. Some work well at both extremes of life. Herring recorded this in the section of the guiding symptoms called States of Life and Constitution. So here we know that age is important. So when you're giving remedies, it's important to know which ones work especially well for those different age levels. Now, we don't have that kind of thing in traditional Western medicine. We don't take into account all these considerations and parameters. Isn't it interesting how more scientific homeopathy is? And here is another point that David Little talks about, sex and sexuality. Some remedies are relatively more characteristic of females, while some are more reflective of males. Some cover problems unique to the female and others male. The sexuality of a human being is closely connected to their physical and emotional health. The frustration of the orgasm reflex and the human need for intimacy leads to physical and psychosexual disorders. A person's sexual ethics, sexual fantasies, sexual performance, and their sense of sexual satisfaction are a rich source of symptoms. And here we have many homeopathic remedies that deal with these issues. They don't give across-the-board Viagra. It's not good for everyone. So we uniquely find the exact match for each person for whatever their condition, their causation, their physical constitution, their mental temperament, all the different things that are going on in their life, including their sexuality. And I will conclude David Little's talk. It says, it is very important that the homeopath understand what makes up the essential nature of the characteristic symptoms of the disease state. Quote, the unprejudiced observer, even the most sharp-witted one, knowing the nullity of supersensible speculations which are not borne out in experience, perceives nothing in each single case of disease other than the alterations in the condition of the body and soul. So we're looking for these alterations, these changes. Disease signs, performance, and symptoms, which are outwardly discernible through the sense. So here Hahnemann is telling us, this is aphorism number 6 of the Ordinon, that these are outward symptoms that we can sense, we can observe. It's not something that we have to do looking into the blood or taking these clinical tests, that the unprejudiced observer, Hahnemann says, only perceives the deviations from the former healthy state of the now sick patient, which are felt by the patient himself, perceived by those around him, and observed by the physician. So all these perceptible signs represent the disease in its entire extent. That is, together they form the only conceivable gestalt of the disease. And there you see that those are the three aspects. It's what the person feels himself, what others can perceive, and then from the impartial observant physician. So we really do need to study and learn and know our remedies and to listen carefully in an unbiased way to the individuals. Okay, I've been talking and talking and going on. There's not that much time, so I will go ahead with the selected Organon aphorisms today. Number 128 states, the most recent observations have shown that medicinal substances, when taken in their crude state by the experimenter for the purpose of testing their peculiar effects, do not exhibit nearly the full amount of the powers that lie hidden in them, which they do when they are taken for the same object in high dilutions potentized by proper trituration and succussion, by which simple operations the powers which in their crude state lay hidden and as it were dormant, are developed and roused into activity to an incredible extent. In this manner, we now find it best to investigate the medicinal powers even of such substances as are deemed weak. And the plan we adopt is to give to the experimenter on an empty stomach daily from 4 to 6 very small globules of the 30th potency of such a substance, moistened with a little water or dissolved in more or less water and thoroughly mixed, and let him continue this for several days. Okay, aphorism number 28 is continuing with Hahnemann's how-to book, How to Do a Proving, with explicit instructions on what to test. And he's saying that normally there are things in our world which we don't consider to be have any medicinal power. And yet, he says, if you turn it into a high dilution, potentize it, shake it, succuss it, triturate it, that you will create an energetic drug, a medicine, that will have some impact on the living organism. And you will be able to see the response by observing what happens to an individual who continues to take this potentized succussed substance over a period of time. And he specifically says that even if it's something that is weak, continue to take it and you're going to eventually see an effect. Take it on an empty stomach. Take it for, he tells you how many globules, in what potency, 30th potency, moistened with water or dissolved in water, and that is the water method. So there's a lot to learn, and there are persons who are experienced supervisors for provings. Aphorism number 129. If the effects that result from such a dose are but slight, a few more globules may be taken daily until they become more distinct and stronger and the alterations of the health more conspicuous. For all persons are not affected by a medicine in an equally great degree. Remember I told you earlier he said that they were hypersensitives. On the contrary, there is a vast variety in this respect, so that sometimes an apparently weak individual may be scarcely at all affected by moderate doses of a medicine known to be of a powerful character, while he is strongly enough acted on by others of a much weaker kind. And on the other hand, there are very robust persons who experience very considerable morbid symptoms from apparently mild medicine and only slighter symptoms from stronger drugs. Now, as this cannot be known beforehand, it is advisable to commence in every instance with a small dose of the drug and, where suitable and requisite, to increase the dose more and more from day to day. And here again, we go back to the quote at the beginning, which was a German proverb, enough is better than too much. It's sort of like when you're going to get a haircut and you're unsure what you want your hair to look like. You don't start by chopping it all off. You go little by little, and you can always remove more of the hair, but you can't put it back. In the same way, we want to see the effect of the remedies at their lowest potency and then gradually add, because as Hahnemann is telling us, every individual is unique in their response, in their way of responding to each and every different remedy. And even though a person may appear to be robust and healthy, they perhaps are very hypersensitive to something that you would consider to be a mild medicine, like lettuce or sweet pea or chickpea or whatever it might be. And they might be not as sensitive to something like a toxin, like a belladonna or a snake poison. So we don't know ahead of time, and that's why we take it slowly, day by day, evaluate every day, check in on the journal and see how the person is doing to determine whether they should continue on taking the remedy or not. Because I do believe that in approving, once the response is initiated and the organism is having changes, we're not going to keep repeating the dosage. I think that there's enough time to read aphorism number 130. If at the very commencement the first dose administered shall have been sufficiently strong, this advantage is gained, that the experimenter learns the order of succession, not succussion, the order of succession of the symptoms, and can note down accurately the period at which each occurs, which is very useful in leading to a knowledge of the genius of the medicine. For then the order of the primary actions, as also that of the alternating actions, is observed in the most unambiguous manner. A very moderate dose, even, often suffices for the experiment, provided only the experimenter is endowed with sufficiently delicate sensitiveness and is very attentive to his sensations. The duration of the action of a drug can only be ascertained by a comparison of several experiments. So in approving, you've got more than one, typically you have more than one person taking the remedy daily, as indicated in Hahnemann's aphorisms here. And there is a supervisor who is overseeing and checking in on each of the provers to see what's going on. And if after the first dose, Hahnemann tells us that is sufficiently strong, that's enough to have initiated a response, that's all that is needed. And now it's just a matter of recording and journaling the continuation, the succession of the symptoms, which he's saying is all the more important, because then you can see a linear progression of how this substance is going to have a medicinal effect in an ill person. What is going to be the prodromal? What is going to be the different stages of the disease that is going to inhabit, the natural disease that's going to inhabit a person? Here, the proving is an artificial disease, but we can reap so much information from it. So here, we're going to learn what happens, why it's different from repeating the dose. So he's saying you're going to see the primary actions in the initial dose, in the one dose. Okay, so here we have aphorism number 131. If, however, in order to ascertain anything at all, the same medicine must be given to the same person to test for several successive days in ever-increasing doses, we thereby learn, no doubt, the various morbid states this medicine is capable of producing in a general manner, not in a linear manner, not in a succession manner, but in a general manner. But we do not ascertain their order of succession. And the subsequent dose often removes curatively some one or other of the symptoms caused by the previous dose. So you see, each time you're repeating the dose and giving it day after day, you may be affecting the initial primary response and acting already curatively in the individual. Or, Hahnemann says, it develops in its stead an opposite state. Such symptoms should be enclosed in brackets to mark their ambiguity until subsequent purer experiments show whether they are the reaction of the organism and the secondary action or an alternating action of this medicine. And if you want to understand that, you're going to have to go back to a previous, a couple of weeks back, we talked about alternating action of the medicine. We talked about secondary and primary actions. And if I can find that for you, I'll give you in the blog a link to those things. So what is he telling us in aphorism number 131? That when we have the repetition of the dose in increasing potencies, we're only going to get the general information and even to question, put them as ambiguous as to what symptoms are being healed or elicited. So you can see how absolutely Hahnemann wants to make sure he's recording the symptoms that a substance can respond in a healthy individual, whether they are curative in action or whether they are the secondary action of the individual or whether they are the primary action. I'm going to read number 132, and then we're out of time for today. 132 says, but when the object is, without reference to the sequential order of the phenomena and the duration of the action of the drug, only to ascertain the symptoms themselves, especially those of a weak medicinal substance, in that case, the preferable course to pursue is to give it for several successive days, increasing the dose every day. In this manner, the action of an unknown medicine, even of the mildest nature, will be revealed, especially if tested on sensitive persons. So here he says, don't hesitate to do repetitions and give it to persons, whether they are sensitive or not, if we are going to be learning the medicinal action of even a weak substance. And I thank you so much for listening. It was a great show. It went fast, and it's time for me to end the show. Go to the Blog Talk Radio, comment, become a listener, and go to the group and read the blogs. Thank you. Have a beautiful week.
Thank you for listening to Who's Reading the Organon with host Debbie Brock on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to take your Organon off the shelf and read it.